days, people used to drop over, unannounced, with children. Pretending not to mind was the neighborly thing to do, as was acknowledging the right of every neighbor who caught your eye to bend your ear. You had to have a good excuse to break off a conversation. Pretending that your barbecue grill was about to burn your house down might work, unless your neighbor sold homeowners insurance for a living. Pretending had a lot to do with neighborliness. The neighborhoods of the 1950s were as make-believe as the Walt Disney Company's planned community celebration. But there was as yet no such job description as imagineering. Our parents had to pretend without professional assistance in their own unimaginative ways. They came from farm villages, small towns, row houses, and tenements, all of which were snug and ethnic, even when the ethnicity was an unspiced American mix of English, German, and Scots-Irish. Everybody was some kind of shirt-tailed cousin or a friend of the family from way back, or had jilted your dad's sister. The old neighborhoods were close-knit in an itchy, scratchy way. When everyone moved out, it was a relief to all concerned. In the new neighborhoods, you didn't know the other people very well, so you had the luxury of pretending to like them. Great store was put on neighborliness, meaning that you took a casserole next door if a neighbor had received a phone call after 9 p.m. And sometimes you dropped over unannounced, with children. People did indeed sit on the front porch and wave to other people sitting on other front porches, and they dutifully continued to do so until the minute a screened-in back porch was added to their house. Children were the main victims of the neighborliness, one tenet of which was that every adult who lived in rough proximity to my house could give me the rough side of his or her tongue. Any childish transgression, actual or potential, was considered sufficient cause. Children were also the main perpetrators of the neighborliness, claiming all front yards and every backyard not occupied by a vicious dog as their commons. A garage with an unlocked door was likewise free space for kids, as were any tree branches, roofs, or porch decks that could be climbed onto. We children were, of course, the whole cause of these neighborhoods. Houses were chosen strictly on the basis of price, price being determined by whether the neighborhood was a safe place to raise kids. Safety was measured by three standards. The first was the extent to which a given neighborhood's adolescents with ducktail haircuts were said to carry switchblades. Once our parents had stretched their budget to find a location with the fewest alleged switchblades, they picked a particular house by making a complex calculation based on the likelihood of children getting run over on busy streets factored into the walking distance to the local grade school. Incidentally, what old-fashioned parents thought of as walking distance to school was much longer than it is now, almost as long as what modern parents think of as a healthy morning run. Then they checked to make sure the basement was dry. Wet basements gave children a cough. You could show our parents Buckingham Palace, and all they'd say is, "It's on a busy street." And, "Does it have a dry basement?" So we grew up in a good and happy place, and we were good. Or we were as good as kids were expected to be. We didn't suffer from childhood obesity, dyslexia, lactose intolerance, or behavioral disorders. We were husky, a little slow at reading, farted a lot, and were pains in the neck. Anyway, we were happy. When I am grown to man's estate, I shall be very proud and great, and tell the other girls and boys not to meddle with my toys. Robert Louis Stevenson, A Child's Garden of Verses. 3. life as we imagined it. Of course, all childhoods are happy, from a worry-burdened, regret-nagged, past 50 skinless chicken breasts for dinner perspective, or after three drinks. Then, being a kid is a beautifully drawn scene, suffused with bright primary colors and drenched in cheer. And I've gotten childhood mixed up with the illustrations of my old Dick and Jane reader. But we in the baby boom were lucky. Children had once been put to work. If not in factories and farmyards, then in the kitchens, cellars, and sculleries of their own homes. We were expected to clear our plates, and this could be finessed by carefully dawdling over our lima beans until Kukla, Fran, and Ollie came on TV. Now, children have been put to work again. Homework started coming home with my children in kindergarten. Weekend assignment, learn to read. They worked at private lessons and every sort of thing while I drive them around in a confusion of picking up kung fu and delivering kumbaya. After the work they do at the lesson, they practice the work they'll do at the next lesson. Recreation is organized according to the time management principles of workplace efficiency. Punch in, punch out. In the dread word, playdate, none of the pleasures of playing or dating are evoked. The kids work hard at sports, as well they should. Sports are an important part of the job of getting into exclusive schools, and while they're working on the essays that accompany the applications to those exclusive schools, the kids need to be well-rounded. So they are drafted into volunteering for community service work. This begins at about age 8, when the children are dragged to the local old age home to annoy the doddering elders with kumbaya sing-alongs and demonstrations of kung fu technique. And it ends, if it ever does, with a postdoctoral unpaid internship at Save the Snakes. How today's kids must yearn for the textile mills and milking stools of yore, where they were occasionally left alone and could play chops with the spindles or have fun yanking the cow's tail. Baby boomers were excused from both the antique and the contemporary forms of youthful travail. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie was on TV. Mom and Dad liked the show, too. For a few blissful years, between the time the Enola Gay landed and the time the helicopter parents took off, children were in control of childhood. There were some rules. Everybody outdoors on nice days. No crossing busy streets. No hitting girls. No firecrackers in your mouth. Come when you're cold for dinner, and everybody indoors when the street lights go on. These rules, like the definition of a nice day, were broadly construed. They were enforced by the General Committee of Grown-Ups with the inefficiency for which committees are famous. All eyes were upon us in the neighborhood, but not looking too closely. And so we ran wild, in a rather tame manner. What we did with our plentiful aggregation of playmates, our copious free time, and our minimal oversight was what right-minded kids have always done with freedom and opportunity. We wasted it. We did, according to the adult conception of doing something, nothing. We played. I don't know that what or how we played differed much from playing as it's always been done. I wonder if play has differed since we were apes. Watching puppies and guppies and my children's baby gerbils, I wonder if it's differed since we became vertebrates. The essence of play is to run around and squeal, or, with guppies, bubble. But it's hard to know to what extent there have been alterations in the nature of childhood play. Many authors have tried to recapture childhood, something that is interesting to real children only if it's done ludicrously, as in the Harry Potter books. Yet authors must, perforce, make stories from the material of their youthful activities, leaving the rest of us who have been children feeling like Tom Sawyer's younger, duller brother. And you'll recall he had one. True play exists outside the realm of plot. You can, if you like, give complication, climax, and denouement to a game of kick the can. But your tragic catharsis is going to be a flop unless you're telling a lot of lies. And people are liars about their childhoods, a trait they pick up from themselves as children. Even the youngest and most innocent children are unwilling to tell the truth about matters of childish importance, how boogers taste, for example. Then we discover our private parts, learn to smoke, get driver's licenses, and forget the realities of childhood. Among the things I've forgotten are the rules for the games we played. I doubt I'd be a successful competitor in even Mother May I, but I'm not sure we remember the rules at the time either. Arguing about a game's rules took longer than the game, and choosing up sides was of greater consequence than whether our side won. Maybe the baby boom was showing its talent for what would become one of our most significant achievements, political impasse and standstill. Nobody thanks us for this now, but consider how the baby boom grew up in the aftermath of a period when politics had been doing anything but standing still, when politics had boldly trooped onto the field for a World War I and a World War II, and was getting ready for a triple header. Not that we kids understood or minded this, but perhaps it affected us subliminally. Or maybe we're just buttheads. Anyway, winning was not the point of baby boom games. We weren't much concerned with winning. Not that we subscribe to today's everyone wins ethos. The point of our games was failure. The fun of the thing was to tag some other kid and make him it, or poison, or out, or to trip him, or tackle him, or bonk him with a ball. And her, too. All runaround and squeal games were mixed sex. They were conducted with a total lack of consideration for the feelings of others that would be the envy of any modern child. The same games still exist, but they are conducted in daycare, rec centers, and playgroups under the tutelage of trained physical activity directors who do remember the rules. Winning is still not the point. Sensitivity is. They probably play inclusion tag. We are all it. Total lack of consideration for the feelings of others has become too valuable to be wasted on kids. The media make billions from it. Boys and girls ran around and squealed together. But outdoor games requiring greater concentration and precision were gender-specific. In my neighborhood, jacks was played only by girls, though the hand-eye coordination gained would have been more useful to boys with their ball sports. Marbles was played only by boys, though girls would have better appreciated the prettiness of the cat's eyes, mibs, and clearies. Thus, the stage was set for dissatisfaction with traditional ideas of masculine and feminine. No doubt Simone de Beauvoir mentions Mibs and Cleary somewhere in The Second Sex. The chalk outline for hopscotch was drawn on the sidewalk by girls, but there was no shame in a boy playing. It was our first inkling that girls are better at anything to which they choose to turn their hand or, in this case, foot. We already knew from school that girls were less foolish. Sometimes a boy would foolishly jump rope with the excuse that boxers did it. What girls pull in double dutch is excellent preparation for divorce court. Parcheesi, chutes and ladders, clue, old maid, crazy eights, and 52 pickup were for rainy days, and if it looked like the rain was never going to stop, we'd get out Monopoly. Despairing of its page upon page of rules, we'd make our own. This is how both Wall Street investment strategy and Washington economic policy were invented by our generation. We also invented selling get-out-of-jail-free cards to the highest bidder. And we made deals with each other that were so complex that by the time six hotels had been placed on Baltic Avenue, none of us had any idea what we were doing. This is the origin of the derivatives market and the real estate bubble. Climate change may not be all bad. The 21st century financial climate was caused by too much rain in the 1950s. Most of our play, however, had nothing to do with games. We liked games, but we looked down on them. Or we thought we should. Later, we'd make playing games a pointed insult. Games, by their nature, have limits. Games cramped our imagination. Imagination was something parents, Captain Kangaroo, Howdy Doody, the Mickey Mouse Club Mouseketeers, and other voices of authority were always urging us to use. Members of the greatest generation were terrible hypocrites about imagination. They refused to use theirs except as a way to create the dullest imaginable life for themselves. Then they turned around and insisted we use ours. The sky's the limit, was one of those phrases bruited about by adults to children 60 years ago. Maybe the adults were beginning to wonder whether and in what way they had reached for it themselves. Dream big, our third grade teacher would say, which was ridiculous coming from someone who ended up teaching third grade. But we didn't know better. So the sky was the limit to our limited ability to make it so, and we dreamed big in our own small way. What we did was make things up. Actually, we didn't. We appropriated characters, circumstances, situations, and settings. Then we engaged in that art form which has come to be so oddly praised, improv. We did so by indulging in that activity which has come to be so oddly deplored, acting out. War was the crux of play among boys. There were six of us, about the same age, who lived at the same end of the block. Billy Stumpf, a year older, was captain. I was lieutenant. Johnny McKay and Steve Penske were a battalion. Bobby Stumpf and Jerry Harris, a year younger, were reinforcements. Any boy from more than half a block away was an Axis power. Love was the crux of play among girls, or love's simulacrum, domesticity. We boys might have tried to avoid girls' play, except that Susie Inwood, who lived next door, could whip any of us. Thus, Bobby and Jerry and Johnny and Steve and Billy and I played house. One benefit was Susie's big comic book collection, a whole milk crate full. Thus, when a blanket had been draped over the swing set or the branches in a brush pile had been arranged to form the rafters of a home, we would sit on the upturned box designated as a couch and do a good imitation of husbands helping in the kitchen. Not that there were any kitchens when we were playing house. We each had a mother to whose kitchen all of us could resort and demand a snack at any moment, as long as that moment was not within half an hour of a designated mealtime. It was a snack to astonish those who believe there's been a decline in the quality of childhood nutrition. A piece of commercial white bread covered in butter, the high-fat content salted kind, and liberally sprinkled with refined sugar. This we ate in that kitchen and not in our house. Nor did we, in our fictitious domicile, participate in any other household activities or perform any household chores. The point of playing house was for the girls to make up their minds about who was mommy and who was daddy and who was baby. All these years later, as far as I can tell, they're still deciding. Among the other forms of girls' play into which we were dragooned was store. It was an opportunity to gather all the money from everybody's Monopoly games and arrange it by denomination in a shoebox. Then, the shoebox full of Monopoly money would be misplaced, making the next game of Monopoly even more like the operations of today's Federal Reserve than it was already. Nothing was ever bought or sold in store. It was a reenactment of the attitude of shopping, a happy pastime. There was no choosiness or haggling or shortage of unreal goods. When we couldn't find the monopoly money, we used our parents' ration tokens left over from World War II. Sometimes the girls would build a lemonade stand by getting the boys to lay planks over sawhorses and the moms to make lemonade in the form of Kool-Aid that was usually grape-flavored, while the girls worked on the sign until all the grape Kool-Aid had been drunk by the boys. The lemonade stand was a virtual business. There was a thing of Susie Inwood's conception called flying horses. We were flying horses. We indicated that we were flying by hooking our thumbs into our armpits and flapping our elbows. There was no point to our being flying horses. We ran around as usual, although this time neighing instead of squealing. There was no drama to our being flying horses. Nothing threatened our felicity. We were as big as horses, and we could fly. We adopted rules for no reason and acted them to no purpose. The case could be made that we created reality TV before we knew anything about reality, or much. There were only three channels about TV. And in a harbinger of what would be a generational trademark, we were sometimes in the mood for dark, edgy, black humor. Then we played school. When it was just boys, we played Robin Hood. Tomato stakes were quarterstaffs. We played Knights of the Round Table with picket fence slat broadswords and garbage can lid shields. After the garbage can lids were taken away from us, the fence slats became dueling foils, or if Mr. Biedermeier had left his outboard motorboat on its trailer in the driveway, pirate sabers. We played cowboys. This was the only time it was permissible for a boy over 5 to skip. Done with our hands held out in front of us, grasping the reins, it was called galloping. We played Indians, but our twig arrows and tree branch and package twine bows didn't amount to much. Indians turned out to be better at hurling beanpole lances at each other and scalping younger brothers with scout knives to the extent that the crew cuts of the period allowed for scalping. We did not, however, play cowboys and Indians. That this showed a nascent multicultural sensitivity is a nice thought. And Tonto did seem like a good guy, while the Lone Ranger was kind of silly. Who was that masked man? Well, who the heck else in the Texas Rangers goes around by himself wearing a mask? But really, playing cowboys and Indians would have required two kinds of role-playing at once. Roping and branding buffalo? Fast-draw tomahawk duels? This would have been overcomplicated. Using our imagination was different than using our brain. A flight of fancy, once embarked upon, requires a dull consistency in the fanciful. Hence some of the longueurs in the later career of the baby boom, such as being entranced with Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, in 1976. We played Superman and Superboy and Superdog as well, if Johnny McKay's German Shepherd couldn't manage to free itself from the pillowcase tucked under its collar. When we raised our arms above our heads, fingers extended and palms down, it was stipulated that we were soaring through the air. But once Superman had landed, a hop on one foot with arms crooked and fists clenched, we didn't know quite what to do with him. He was too super. Nobody could fight him. And fighting was our chief joy. We played war across the front yards, war in the local park, war indoors with foxholes behind the Davenport and snipers at the top of the stairs. We were usually the Marines, sometimes the Army, but never the Navy, because sailors drowned instead of being dramatically wounded and bleeding to death, while bravely urging our platoon to leave us behind. and take the hill. Sometimes we were the German army. Nazis were to be deplored, but they had cool uniforms. Our part of the state had been settled by Germans, and most of our war veteran fathers had, perhaps not coincidentally, been stationed in the Pacific. The exception being Mr. Meinhof across the street, who was quick to point out that he'd fought on the Russian front. The Japanese sounded funny and wore funny uniforms with puttees and soup bowl helmets and were more fun to kill. The six of us were all on one side in these wars. Not that there was another side. Combat was waged against never-invincible, always-invisible enemies. After the wars, there was war, on the living room rug or along the upstairs hall or in Mum's herbaceous borders with lead soldiers. We had hundreds of lead soldiers. We made them ourselves. Billy Stumpf's dad supplied the molds. My dad brought home tire weights from the dealership where he sold cars. Billy and I melted the lead in a ladle on an old hot plate in the basement workshop surrounded by paint thinner and wood shavings. Parents put a great premium on children quietly amusing themselves. Soldiers that came out of the mold missing a leg or a rifle were painted blue. These were the French. We let Bobby paint them. If Billy and Bobby and I had done a particularly good job of quietly amusing ourselves, Mr. Stumpf would lead us up to the attic and show us a roll of banknotes he'd taken from the body of a Japanese soldier during the Battle of Okinawa. The bloodstains were an exciting dark brown. Mr. Stumpf also taught us how to make machine gun noises by vibrating our tongues and how to yell, "Die, you rousy Americans!" and "Banzai!" in a Japanese accent. He served in the Korean War, too, where he was an artillery officer. I remember sitting on the lawn with Billy and Bobby while Mrs. Stumpf read a letter from her husband at the front. "Dear Ellen, we were shelling the Chai Coms today, and I wrote your name on a shell, and Billy's and Bobby's names on another shell, and our dog Sam's name on a third. I don't know where the idea of the reticent vet came from, the combat soldier who never speaks of his battlefield experience. Our parents told war stories all the time, including my mother, who'd been in the Women's Marine Corps. She was a control tower operator at Cherry Point, North Carolina, and witnessed more carnage on the runway than most dads had seen overseas. Our enthusiasm for fighting extended to snowball fights, water balloon fights, dirt fights where new houses were being built, and fruit and nut fights when crabapples and buckeyes were in season. But only by accident, or an occasional ice ball, did anyone get hurt. The fighting rarely degenerated into a fight. We would wrestle angrily, or try to give each other a kick in the shins at the most. Knockdowns and dragouts were unusual among baby boom children. This must have been our own doing. We rarely heard adults, male adults anyway, voice sincere disapproval of boys slugging each other. "So hit him back," our dads would tell us. My grandfather would happily recount how, as a 12-year-old mechanic's apprentice, he'd fight his way to work through the boys in the Polack, hunky, and colored neighborhoods, and fight his way back home at night. To us, this seemed inconceivable, or like something from several blocks away where the poor kids lived, and boys slugged each other all the time. Being poor back then, like joining ROTC later, meant you weren't a real baby boomer. I once threw a roundhouse right at Steve Penske. So unused to punching was I, and so unused to ducking punches was he, that I put my fist into the side of the house, and he banged his head on the drainpipe. And when the Vietnam War arrived, only one of us, Bobby Stumpf, went. The rest of us had excuses. Billy Stumpf's spleen was ruptured from high school football. Steve Penske developed allergies. Johnny McKay got migraines. Jerry Harris came down with asthma. We used our imagination. Maybe, he said hesitantly, maybe there is a beast. What I mean is, maybe it's only us. William Golding, Lord of the Flies. 4. In the Doldrums of Fun. School, given the amount of childhood that's spent in it, should form a greater part of this picture, but it doesn't. School was just there, inexorable, inevitable, and almost escape-proof. In our childhood, school life held the place that real life would occupy in our adulthood. You could avoid school, but only by doing things that were worse or had worse consequences, such as getting sick or telling wild lies, the juvenile equivalents of dying or going to Promises Malibu. There were public schools and Catholic schools, mostly indistinguishable, except that in the latter you learned about the infinite mercy of the Blessed Virgin Mary and got your knuckles whacked more often. Schools were big buildings. They resembled fortifications or castles. But they had been carefully designed to avoid any suggestion of the romance associated with citadels, strongholds, and keeps. The windows were large to give children plenty of the healthy sunlight that didn't used to cause skin cancer, and lots of air during the climate change that happened only twice a year, spring and fall, instead of all the time. Through those large windows, we learned what a wide and wonderful world it is, and how much we'd love to be out in it. Some of the massive public schools that were built in the first third of the 20th century haven't yet been torn down or repurposed, but their windows have been replaced with insulated panels that leave just a slit of casements for students to peer through. And we wonder at the increase in childhood suicide rates. School started at 8:30. Before the doors opened, children were expected to form two lines, one for the boys and one for the girls. The boys pushed each other. The girls teased each other. We would have been better behaved if we'd been mixed together, but the people who insist on organizing life and the people who have no idea how life is organized were and always will be the same people. Classrooms were well populated. I count 42 children in my third grade class picture. The teacher was, until junior high, invariably a woman, usually single and alone at her station of command. Teacher's aides had not yet been sent to the aid of teachers. Busybody parents weren't sticking their noses in from the back row. Elected representatives of the school board weren't visiting to make sure that the curriculum was conformist or that the curriculum was nonconformist, according to which kind of nut won the school board election. Not that our teachers needed such assistance. They wielded the kind of unalloyed power that God used to have in the Old Testament before 1950s Sunday school teachers got to him. Corporal punishment was not unknown in public schools, but its infrequency and the seemingly random nature of its application made it less a deterrent than a suburban legend. Paddling gave us a sort of campfire story to tell on the way home from school. And then he was sent to the principal. The more effective disciplinary measure was to send us to sit in the hall. A break from the crowded, busy classroom would have been a relief to a sensible generation, but we are a sensitive generation and can't stand to be isolated. The worst penalty we could devise when we got children of our own was to give them a time out. Probably the tykes were thinking, like many people who have had experience with our generation, please make it two. Our teachers were not old bats by any means. Many were fresh from their L.Ed. major at state universities and full of innocent enthusiasm. Others were old bats. Pedagogical methods combine the hopelessly old-fashioned with the hopelessly new-fangled. There was still copious rote learning and much copying of things from blackboards. We were made to memorize the alphabet both forward and backward, the latter being something I most certainly can't do to this day. I didn't have much success with the former, either. When I use the dictionary, I'm still singing the ABC song. My parents bought the 45, and I played it on a little red record player. I used to catch myself among Y and Z words, mouthing the lyrics of the final verse. Now I know my ABCs, aren't you very proud of me? Sometimes aloud, which occasioned looks in the college library. We were taught to read with flashcards. You can remember it's the word look because it has two I's in the middle. This is not conducive to good spelling. It's no accident that spell check is a product of the baby boom, and no accident that we misspelled spell check. Anything to get out of L-I-I-K-I-N-G up words in the dictionary. On the other hand, history and geography had been replaced with social studies. By the end of grade school, we were well prepared to go out and take Margaret Mead's place in Samoa, if we had known where Samoa was. We studied the handicrafts, songs, and square dances of the American pioneers. We knew everything about frontier life except when it happened and why. There was a great fad for coonskin caps, thanks to the Walt Disney Show's Davy Crockett episodes, which were only slightly less historically inaccurate than Margaret Mead. We understood that pioneers wore coonskin caps. We didn't understand that they'd had to eat the raccoon first. One lesson the baby boom did learn was that we were being bored on purpose. Until we understood school, we regarded boredom as an accident. Nobody to play with. Nothing but name that tune on TV. At its worst, during Thanksgiving dinner with a relentlessly joshing Uncle Timmy, or on a visit to Grandma's ancient friend who was under the impression that children liked whorehound candy, boredom was the result of mistakes in attempts to entertain us. Being boring was a fault, not a vice. It had never occurred to us that boredom could be premeditated. Our generation does not believe in original sin. But we do believe that Adam and Eve were boring. We take it on faith that humankind has fallen from divine enjoyment of life. We carry the burden of blasé and are continually tempted to ennui in thought and deed. We can be restored to an Edenic state only by the grace of the interesting. We know this from school and from Sunday school, scouting, summer camp, and organized sports. If you weren't bored by these institutions and activities, you weren't paying attention. Let us not commit an intentional fallacy. The grown-ups bored us. They had a purpose for doing so. Therefore, they bored us on purpose. That is not to say they meant to bore us. Quite the contrary with Sunday school teachers who tried everything to make religion entertaining. God, how they failed. The tedium of Sunday school, though less frequent and prolonged than the tedium of school, produced greater hopelessness and despair. It was a theft from the heavenly gift to us kids, the weekend. In church basements all over America, the gospel of Mark 10:14 was being invoked. Suffer the little children to come unto me, leaving little children wondering what they'd done to deserve the suffering. And the children shall rise up against their parents, Matthew 10:21. But that verse was never taught. Jesus should have been frighteningly interesting. He was undead. He wore his bathrobe outdoors. He had a beard. The halo thing meant he glowed in the dark. But by the time the Sunday school teachers were finished with him, all the gee whiz had been taken out of Jesus. He was always patient, kind, gentle, and understanding. The people we knew who were like that were really dull, except Mom. And Mom would give us hell sometimes, while Jesus, we were told, was giving us the other place. The glory of the other place was so vaguely described that it's easy to understand why our generation would mistake getting high on drugs for it. Hell should have been fascinating. But the Sunday school teachers explained it as a sort of absence without an excuse from meeting God. Meeting God. This sounded worrisome. But hell went on forever. This sounded like Sunday school. Despite my name, both my parents were milquetoast Protestants. The O'Rourkes had been Catholic, but in the 1920s, my widower grandfather divorced his lunatic second wife. She had put her stepchild, my dad's baby brother, later to become over-jocular Uncle Timmy, out on the back steps in the snow as punishment for wetting his pants. His underwear froze. The Catholic Church refused to grant an annulment. Granddad got so angry that he joined the Freemasons, the Republican Party, and the Lutheran Church all in one day. It's a family story that is, as we journalists say, too good to check. Mom came by her Presbyterianism honestly. During the 1950s, denominations of the Lutheran, Presbyterian, Methodist, and Episcopalian kind had fitted the light of the world with a lampshade, so it wouldn't produce distracting salvational glare and dampen the fires of perdition to avoid spiritual smoke inhalation. A stillness of the soul and a quiet reverence during church services had been turned into sitting still and being quiet. Catholic kids had the advantage of scary nuns, still in full habits. Did they have hair? Did they have feet? Priests performing the mumbo-jumbo of the Latin Mass were almost as impressive as stage magicians. A Catholic priest could probably pull a quarter out of your ear. That he could do something else in some other place of yours was not yet a popular article of faith. And saints were all over the place with special powers like comic book superheroes, but more numerous and more outlandishly costumed, although beset with really a lot of kryptonite causing them to be martyred all the time. And there were kids like Johnny McKay who went to the other kind of Protestant church, the kind in a cement block building with a clever sign out front. C-H-R-C-H. Today, what's missing? You are. Never mind that much of the congregation and maybe the preacher hadn't finished high school. Here was learning and culture. Worshippers were the heirs of Jonathan Edwards, one of colonial America's great religious thinkers, and conversant with the brilliant prose style of his Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Consider the fearful danger you are in. 'Tis a great furnace of wrath, a wide and bottomless pit, full of the fire of wrath. You hang by a slender thread, with the flames of divine wrath flashing about it. Their religion had special effects. My religion had specific evasions. The more specific the query I made, the more evasive was the response. How come Santa isn't in the creche at Christmas? Baby Jesus is getting presents from the three wise men, but nothing from Santa? Does the Easter Bunny come before or after Jesus rises? When the rock was rolled back, was the candy inside or outside the tomb? What does the Holy Ghost dress up as on Halloween? Baby boomers mock born agains. Or we do until we get cancer, go to jail, or reach the higher power part of the 12-step program. But Christian fundamentalists can answer these questions, and we can't. Scouting was Sunday school with mission creep. There was God and country, and for some reason both were in the great outdoors. The proper way to show respect for God and country when they were outdoors was to adopt pseudo-military dress and behavior. We liked wearing the uniforms until we realized immediately that they looked stupid. We did not actually go outdoors much. Most scouting was done in the church gymnasium, but at least it was on a weeknight. I remember maybe three camping trips in my 5 years of desultory participation in the Boy Scouts. It rained. Boy Scout was not a term of endearment among the greatest generation. They'd had enough of military dress and behavior, pseudo or otherwise. There was no superabundance of dads volunteering to be scoutmasters. Organizational details were left to high school-aged Eagle Scouts who didn't, even we could tell, have much of a life at high school. Cub Scouts got no male supervision at all. Den mothers did their best. As a crafts project for our den, Johnny McKay's mother chose painting china figurines of choir boys. She had the figurines glazed in the kiln belonging to Mrs. Furstein, who lived one block over and was arty. I don't think this was what Baden-Powell had in mind. When we graduated to the Boy Scouts proper, there was the knot tying. What a tangled skein of cordage had to do with God and country was not clear. What was to be done in the great outdoors with a big snarl of rope wasn't clear either. Study of the classics was not a strong point in 1950s education. If we had known the legend of Alexander the Great and the Gordian Knot, we would have used our scout knives on something besides our little brother's hair and sliced right through the hopeless clumps of failed half-hitches, sheet-bends, and bowlines. Or anyway, we would have cut ourselves free from the Boy Scouts. As it was, the knottiness prefigured a generational tendency to find the most complex solutions to our problems. Healthcare reform, variable rate, subprime mortgages, and Microsoft Word come to mind. First aid was also taught. If you need it, you'd better hope someone my age doesn't get to you first. And there were weak attempts to memorize semaphore flag signals and do other things that didn't engage our attention, followed by battle ball. Steve Penske and I were charged with forming a new patrol. We chose the name Bat Patrol. We had the coolest patrol badge. Our patrol's call was an inaudible to human ears. We weren't any good at going to summer camp either, as Woodstock was to prove. Summer camp was basic. Leaky forest, fence cabins, mucky mess hall, and a lake that smelled like greasy food. In time, our generation would become fans of the primitive, the rustic, the crude, and the clumsily handmade. But not when our parents were paying for it. We played capture the flag at summer camp. The point of the game was to lose the unpopular kids in the woods. At my camp, everyone was unpopular. Summer camp was an exercise in doing things we didn't want to do with people we didn't know. A nature hike with a bunch of strangers was a lot like going to work. We and the baby boom put that off for as long as we could, but when we did go to work, on politics, finance, media, and the Internet, we did so with such a will that we almost wrecked the country. So summer camp must have been a suitable preparation. Organized sports, as they were foisted upon us, had only a tenuous relationship to real sports, the kind we and our dads rooted for on radio and television. My friends and I didn't make a mental connection between Little League and the Cleveland Indians, or even between Pop Warner football and the athletic glories on display from September through Thanksgiving in our local high school stadium. Part of the problem was the fan base. Our parents didn't come down from the stands at our games and hit coaches, opposing players, and each other in swell melees that went viral and got like a million hits on YouTube. Such behavior was inconceivable. It would have meant that our parents had come to our games. Our parents were home, getting a little peace and quiet while sports kept us out of trouble. Meanwhile, we could imagine ourselves as sports stars, but not while playing under adult supervision. There was too much supervising. We had just crossed the finish line and won the Indianapolis 500 in our soapbox derby racer when somebody yelled, "Fly ball, you dummy!" Our parents imagined us as sports stars, too, when they bothered to take time off from imagining sports were keeping us out of trouble. That playing sports is a way to meet kids who are real trouble is something we never told Mom and Dad. Our parents imagined, if the kid has talent, maybe he'll get a scholarship to Youngstown State. But even if the dream came true, sports were regarded as a likely road to an income in the high four figures, teaching gym someplace with the summer off for standing in the weeds at a public park yelling, "Fly ball, you dummy!" We suffered from an emphasis on good sportsmanship. We weren't allowed to pump our fists in the air, exchange high fives, do sack dances, or prance around in the end zone as if we had deep heat in our jock straps. We were reduced to bragging to smaller children, out of adult earshot. And the purchase of a first jock strap was a painful humiliation. Our mothers hovered nearby. The size we required was invariably small. We worshipped our sports heroes, collected their bubblegum-packed baseball cards, followed their exploits in the sports pages as well as we could in the balderdash of sports writing, and argued about whether, if Rocky Marciano played baseball and Mickey Mantle was a boxer, who would win? We worshipped our sports heroes, but we didn't identify with them. Wearing an imitation item of Stan Musial's uniform to school would have been as odd as wearing Batman's cape. We'd be laughed at and sent home. Maybe pro athletes are more approachable in the guilty minds of boys now that felony indictment has become a sports statistic. We were never asked whether we liked sports. Some of us did. Billy and Bobby Stump were good at sports. For the rest of us, "Pat's batting, everybody move in. Jerry's on your team, he was on our team last time. Bobby, run the button hook. Billy, fall back and pass. And Steve and Johnny, you two, go deep." Liking sports wasn't the point. But the adults informed us, being good at sports wasn't the point either. This left quite a few of us wondering, what's the point? The point was to learn teamwork and leadership. The greatest generation was big on teamwork. I can't think why. They had just lost China with their Chiang Kai-shek team, been stalemated in Korea on the UN team, and were in the middle of a Cold War that was the result of having been former teammates with the Soviet Union. When corporations teamed up, it was called a monopoly and needed to be stopped with antitrust laws. When workers teamed up, it was called Jimmy Hoffa and needed to be investigated by the FBI. But out on the sports field, we were told, there is no I in team. And what with the way we were taught to spell in the 1950s, we had to think about that one. Our parents were also big on leadership, while at the same time being grossly cynical about leaders. They would say things like, Ike wanted to be president because then he'd get two pensions when he retired. They'd impute base motives to those in positions of even the least authority. The paper boy knows the Ryans are on vacation, so he delivered their paper to us and saved himself 3 cents. And they knew what happened to youthful leaders. Our parents remembered D-Day. They themselves were experts in leading from behind, preferably from behind a beer at home while we played Little League. Maybe all generations want their children to have what they did not. Or maybe they didn't love us as much as we think. The point of organized sports was teamwork and leadership. As far as I could tell from questioning adults, the point of everything they cajoled us into doing, sports, scouting, religious instruction, summer camp, was teamwork and leadership. I wonder what kind of leader I was supposed to become by getting beaned at home plate, making granny knots, being paired on the buddy system in the Lakehead camp with a kid who ran away and hid in the latrine, and thinking up three questions to ask Jesus if he came to our church bake sale. And I wonder what kind of team would want a semi-conscious, tangled-up, soaking-wet agnostic team member. When you hear these days that there's no teamwork or leadership in Congress, the White House, business, industry, education, civil society, or at home when it's time to decide who's making dinner, it's because the baby boomers would rather have been watching TV. Even name that tune. And, by the way, why is it that the TV of the 1950s, along with the suburbs and the tail fins, take so much grief from deep thinkers? In a 1961 speech, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Newton N. Minow, now, there's a name for a deep thinker, told the National Association of Broadcasters right to its face that television was a vast wasteland. As if, before TV, my family spent the evening playing chess and Tchaikovsky. Leave It to Beaver is still taking a beating as the exemplar of all that's tepid and bogus in our baby boom cultural heritage. This pleasantly written and acted diversion featured a masterful portrayal of Silent Generation Iago Light in Eddie Haskell. Is the depiction of middle-class baby boom life in Leave It to Beaver less acute and penetrating than the depiction of middle-class Elizabethan life in Shakespeare's Merry Wives of Windsor? Which entertainment winks more often at moral turpitude? And tell the truth, which would you rather sit through? Not to go off on another digression, although the baby boom has always been inclined to wander from the main subject whenever we can get a hall pass, but unfounded objections to tract houses, DeSoto's, and Beaver Cleaver make you fear for the mental well-being of intellectuals. We are not a highly intellectual generation, and who can blame us? Baby boom girls didn't mind the boredom as much as baby boom boys. Girls could see into the future. This was evident in the way girls played with dolls that had doll houses full of sinks, toilets, bassinets, and other items of real futurity, plus doll clothes and somebody's older brother from down the block who'd rip Barbie's blouse off to look at her breasts. Meanwhile, boys were playing with one-legged lead soldiers that were French. Girls knew that the tedium of school was a necessary preparation for the tedium of home and family. And baby boom girls had an intuition that their tedium would extend beyond home and family to professions, corporate management, and the State Department. They'd better get ready to be bored. Boys were driven crazy. Literally, crazy, as defined in the current edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. The diagnostic criteria for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder include makes careless mistakes in schoolwork, does not seem to listen, is often easily distracted, fidgets with hands or feet or squirms in seat, runs about or climbs excessively, has difficulty playing or engaging in leisure activities quietly. These boys have been accurately diagnosed as boys. Now there are drugs to treat it. The medications are what baby boomers would call uppers. The recommended therapy for ADHD is essentially dating fat girls to get their diet pills to study for exams. It's a shame, although not because Ritalin, Adderall, Vyvanse, Concerta, and whatever lead to a lifetime of drug dependency and squalor. I came of age in the 1960s. A lifetime of drug dependency and squalor has its points. But kids are sitting still after the bell, engrossed in their schoolwork and being denied the benefits of the fantasy life induced by utter boredom. Our school